Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 549.RV0320, certificate number 12881, the Green River Ordinance.
You ever sold anything door to door?
Yeah. Well,
band candy?
Not sold, but I was a canvasser for. For the Clean Air Act and
working for the Nixon administration.
Clean Water Act. I was canvassing for the Clean Water Act for the National Environmental Law Center in the greater Washington, D.C. area when I lived there. So I was out in Virginia and Maryland, outside the Beltway.
And that, did that pay?
It did.
So this environmental group was buying all your drugs, basically.
Yeah, well, they were buying my drugs. You know, it was one of the things. It was part of the. It was part of the PIRG system, the Public Interest Research Group, which was a sort of Ralph Nader universe of advocacy groups that would then lobby people in Congress. And
I guess that's why those people all moved to clipboards on corners, right? That whole.
Yeah,
home canvassing went away.
Right, stand outside the drugstore.
Yeah.
I kind of moved up the ranks of the organization fairly quickly over the course of a few months. They're always looking for true believers.
Were you good at it? Is that why?
I was, yeah. I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and think about those few times where I really blew it. One time I got somebody to give me a $500 check. And then in the space of a couple of blocks, lost the check. I'd never lost another check, but I lost this $500 check. And I actually went back a couple of hours later and was like, ding dong. Hey, I lost that check. I don't suppose there's any way that you could write me another one. And the woman was so like, what? That's outrageous. And I was like, I know it's terrible, but you really made my day. She wouldn't do it.
I can see why. You no longer seem like a respectable person to donate to.
Because we had a great rapport. She invited me in. She gave me a cup of coffee. We sat and talked. It was great. And then
you lost her check.
I blew it. And then there was another time where a politically savvy blonde lady who at the time seemed really old but was probably 38 in like a pencil-skirted suit. Invited me in, and she had a red convertible Jaguar in the front, and we had a really great conversation about politics, but I realized that this was a Penthouse Forum episode, and right. I was such a dork that I was like, okay, well, it's been nice to meet you. I hope you vote for the Berberderberder, and she was just like,
Come on, kid. Well, you didn't want to demean the Pergiverse or whatever you're in.
No, I didn't, but
But
I felt later like
to score with Beltway.
Come
wives.
On, there aren't that many times when you have one of these. Like I was canvassing door to door. Turns out,
and you later found out that was Pat Schroeder.
Yeah, I totally blew it.
You later found out that was Katherine Graham.
But the problem was as I got closer and closer to the legal side of it, the people that were actually doing. I went to a couple of meetings on Capitol Hill with the lawyers who were all Ivy League. Lawyers who were donating their time to this wonderful cause. And I said more than once, like, show me exactly how the money we raise goes to the passage of the Clean Water Act. Just walk me through.
And were they like, look over there?
Yeah, it got real weird. And at that point, I got a little disillusioned.
Are those things all kind of scammy and self-perpetuating?
No, not scammy, but there is a lot of just lobbying, which is champagne.
Yeah, and the lobbying
dinners.
Pays for the lobbying.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, this is just more of the same. Because I was an idealist at the time, and I was like, wait a minute, we shouldn't be taking out these people for dinner.
Well, to this day, I'll get asked. Some friend will be like, hey, I bought a table at the blah, blah, blah fundraiser. Why don't you guys come? And I think, why don't I just write a check to that amazing low-income housing cause or whatever, and then they don't have to blow 60% of my donation on whining and dining Seattle liberals at some stupid charity auction.
It's so true. My mom always, when the soccer team or whatever else would say, we're going to have a cookie drive. We're going to sell cookies out in front of the furniture store. She was always like, let me write you a check for $250. And of course, they're like, okay, great. And then the cookies. And she's like, no cookies.
Let me explain to you what school districts are really good about that now. They'll be like, here's the calendar. It's a bake sale in October. In December, it's the band candy. And Thursday, you know, and then at the end, they're like, or you can write us a check for $375.
Yeah, right. And so every time, because I do remember trying to sell raffle tickets out in front of the Dosey's furniture store, which was on Aurora at kind of up by where you used to live, where you were a kid, kind of by Edmonds.
By the Aurora Village or north of Aurora Village?
Just north of Aurora Village. There was a Dosey's, which was a huge furniture store. And I remember being out there in the rain in my Cub Scout outfit selling raffle tickets and people just walking by me, not even giving me a glance. And feeling just more and more devastated, you know, rain dripping off of my Cub Scout hat, like, please, sir, you know, please, matches for sale, matches. And it hurt me so badly to be rejected by that many adults. And how many people are going into a furniture store?
Yeah, but, not a lot of foot traffic.
But it seemed like a lot. It seemed like people after people.
Wasn't there like a Jafco like three blocks north? Why are you in a furniture store?
This was back when people, I guess, bought a lot of furniture. But anyway, my mom came to pick me up and saw me standing there, you know, just shoulders slumped, having sold zero wet raffle tickets. And she said, never again. I'm just as dumb. I'm not subjecting you to this. And so I've kind of adopted that mentality.
I mean, I've been a Mormon missionary, so you're not going to pull my heartstrings I had to stand in the rain with people who didn't want to talk to me.
Oh, you went around Spain. You talked to every single person in Spain.
Yeah, I had a whole country full of people that didn't want to talk to me, and rightly so.
So what's the return on that? How many people did you meet that were so either so dissatisfied with Catholicism or so just like not committed that they were like, you know what? Yes.
Well, proselytization is always kind of a weird project anyway, right. And possibly a colonialist one or whatever else you want to say about it.
I don't think if you're looking for people to
I'm coming from Utah to Spain, we're not going to colonize them anytime soon.
No, the colonial thing really went in one direction from Spain, I think.
In fact, it's revenge, actually. This is your new world religion coming back to...
That's right. Here comes the Protestantism.
I wish I had some measles to give you as well, sir, but all I have is Christianity.
But was it validating? It must have been validating. You must have felt like you were doing a good job.
The idea is you're not actually out there to convince people, you know, because you can't.
Right.
Like, you can't stand in front of a furniture store and be like, hey, who wants a new religion?
Is it just like impressions? You're trying to generate impressions?
I'm trying to get page views. I think the idea is there's a small number of people who are seekers for whatever.
Yes.
And they will want to stop and talk. So you're just like a public utility. And I've noticed during COVID, the Jehovah's Witnesses took this up as well. You know, they would just...
I was seeing them all over the place.
Yeah, but they wouldn't go door to door anymore. They would just stand with a sandwich board somewhere, and every person that went by, they were witnessing, because, hey, those people could have been like, hey, I want to be a Jehovah's Witness.
Well, that's the thing. In a way, I love the Jehovah's Witnesses, because they are out there with their sandwich board, and they're dressed nicely, and they do not say, hey, would you like to stop and talk? They just stand there. And you walk past and you nod and they nod. So they're just waiting for you to...
I think in general, when they do door-to-door stuff, I think they tend to be more a little more pugnacious than...
Yeah.
Because the Mormons will be, you know, you can say the Mormons, I'm not interested, and be like, yes, sir, have a nice day. Whereas the Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, might be a little more prone to be like, well, you know what the Bible will tell you about that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Mormons just take one of their magic pens out of their pocket protector and go click and write it down on a sheet, right?
Don't go back to 309 Masterson Street. Did you enjoy doing door-to-door canvassing stuff? Like,
did I enjoy it?
Like, did the people want to talk? Did you want to talk?
You know, in the Beltway, it's generally a liberal place. And I met...
Yeah, you're telling me about the deep state.
Yeah, that's right.
Drain the swamp.
I met so many interesting people. Like, I would go into a place and it would be full of artifacts from somewhere. And I would go, where did that mask come from? Oh, I was in the State Department in Kazakhstan back in the 60s. And then I would just sit rapt as they, you know, asking questions. And so I met all these characters that I wouldn't have met otherwise. But I'm also, like, deep inside an introvert. And so...
It does take it out of you.
Yeah. Every door I knocked on just took, like 5 vitamins out of me. And by the end of the day, I was just torqued.
And if, you know, if you're meeting a, some kind of, you know, tipping point of people who actually do want to talk and hear your spiel, that's one thing, but there's a sense of futility when you're pretty sure that the vast majority of the people whose doors you knock on do not want to talk about religion in the same way that I would not were they to knock on my door.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm just here as a utility to the one person in 1,000 who might, but I deeply apologize to the rest of you and your countrymen.
If you're knocking on doors in Seattle trying to outlaw transgender ideology, you're going to find that's a hard job.
It's, do you ever have door-to-door sales of any kind in the Northwest?
Well, yeah, what we get here is like, hey, I noticed that your windows could be replaced.
You know, we have fiber optic now.
One time not very long ago, I opened the door to a little old man who was probably 80, and he said, I'm an arborist, and I notice your trees need pruning. And I was like, you are not an arborist. And he was like, I was one. And I said,
that dude's the first arborist.
I was like, what are you doing? You're not climbing up that tree. No, no, no. They just hired me to go around and. And so I said, well, yeah, why don't you send them by? I could talk to somebody about that ash tree that is falling over. And I did.
I had college friends do door-to-door pest control, but I think it was kind of scammy.
Oh, I've had that.
I don't know if the pest control was good or not, but I think the sales guys were getting scammed.
It just feels like that whole racket is they come by every 4 months and spray for ants. You're like, I feel like if you come by once a year, that's plenty.
That's a pretty mild scam if they're just spraying 3 times as much for ants as they're supposed to. If I'm going to get scammed, that's the kind I want.
When I had raccoons and possums in the walls, I was grateful for them because they came and trapped those guys. They didn't like kill the possum in the wall.
But did you wait for some door-to-door person to be like, hey, do you have any extra raccoons? We have a service.
No, I made a phone call about, I have possums in the walls. Please come.
Well, that's how the world works now.
Yeah.
You reach out. You don't sit at home thinking, boy, someday I'm going to get a vacuum or an encyclopedia, but someone needs to bring it to me and sell me on it.
You remember Tupperware parties where the moms all gathered and... Boy, that's an omnibus in the making.
Well, let's talk about the whole world of door-to-door sales because, you know, it's almost as old as the current model of I go to a market and I get what I want. There were itinerant wagons full of peddlers with their wares.
Weren't they originally like sharpening your knives and shoeing your horses type of thing?
Tinkers and tinkers repairing your tinware. I mean, in the United States... the peddler in such a vast spread out country, people didn't have access to a lot of goods and you relied on itinerant peddlers to pull up in their wagon and say, here's what I got.
Medicine made out of opium.
Yeah. There were a lot of, snake oil type elixirs, but also just tablecloths and flatware and house goods that you you couldn't go to Kmart for.
Couldn't get from the Montgomery Ward catalog.
I mean, that's what your other option would be, the Wells Fargo wagon. But a lot of these peddlers, I mean, often we think of them as Yankee peddlers, kind of sharp traders telling stories.
Or Jewish peddlers.
That's what a lot of them were. Between 1780 and 1920, I was just reading some research on this, about half of the Jewish population of the Old World, Europe, Middle East, North Africa, left, mostly for the New World. Some for South Africa or Australia, but largely the Americas.
I wonder why.
Well, that's the thing. We think of this as we think of the Jewish diaspora as solely a response to anti-Semitic horrors, and certainly there were no shortage of those.
Pogroms and whatnot.
Yep. But in a lot of these cases, it was the same reason immigrants left the Old World for everybody, just because they thought there was more opportunity.
Right.
In a new place.
There were fewer potatoes in Europe than there had been before.
Fewer potatoes than you were hungry for. And in this case, a lot of them became peddlers. They became traveling salespeople. And it was not what we the kind of anti-Semitic battleground you would expect. They were kind of, they would often show up at places where they would be beloved because they would have all the news.
Oh, of course.
You know, hey, here's somebody to talk to. This is the first person we've seen in a week and a half, honey. And, you know, a good Methodist or Presbyterian family would put up this Jewish traveler. He'd be able to stay the night in the house or the barn. Often he would be asked to read the Bible. Now, Isaac, are you one of the Hebrews? I thought you were. Would you do us the honor of reading to us from the Bible before we hit the hay?
Oh, that's nice. And he had news about what President Johnson was doing or what the...
I hope you mean Andrew and not Lyndon.
I do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he'd have news of the world. And I don't want to paint too rosy a picture here, but the scholarship I was reading was just kind of painting a world that was less reliant on the awful anti-Semitism you might expect. Because it was a time when... Well, two things had happened in the Americas. First, the Industrial Revolution meant that there were things that middle-class people could buy that they could afford.
That they couldn't make.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you want a nice tea service, and you know what? Like, if your sorghum crop was good this year, you could afford a factory tea service.
Right.
And you couldn't make it yourself. Also, westward expansion meant that a lot of people had spread out over a part of the nation where they no longer had a nice house full of stuff yet. And they kind of headed for Ohio or the Dakotas or whatever under the assumption that when they got there, they'd be able to buy a tablecloth.
Yeah.
And they'd be able to buy a milk pitcher. And it was going to be one of these Yankee peddlers, Jewish peddlers in a wagon pulled by a donkey.
Because when they filled up the wagon, they had to make sure that mama's piano was in it, and they weren't able to bring the tablecloth.
And a lot of the reason why these Jewish emigres, Old World emigres, wound up in the U.S. is because if you're going to sell something, do it in a place that has no... If you're going to sell something to Christians, do it in a place that has no state religion. You can emigrate to Norway, but everybody there is monolithically the Church of Norway. You know, it's all Lutherans.
Right.
And you're going to be the one Jewish guy in town.
And the United States didn't have a history of anti-Semitism because it was all... Everybody was...
We were waiting.
Yeah, that's right. We were developing other prejudices.
And we had big plans for anti-Semitism too. But you're right. Like, in a place that's kind of post-state church, then, you know, sure, the Johnsons down the way are Methodists, and these folks over here are Episcopalian, and he's a Baptist, and the guy that sold me these shears was a Hebrew fella.
My mom grew up in Western Ohio, and she said there wasn't any anti-Semitism there because none of them, it had never occurred to any of them that they would
ever meet a, ever Jewish, meet person?
A Jewish person. So they were all really against the Catholics.
The other thing that drew a lot of these immigrants was the idea that there would be class mobility here, both for the buyer and the seller.
Of course.
You know, the person buying the stuff would be like, this is the first new pair of shoes I've ever owned, or he's got a camera. You know, we could own a camera. We could own reading glasses.
But the seller would be able to one day open a store.
That's what happened. You know, you didn't have a... There's very low overhead to wander around with a mule cart full of stuff, but you did that because your kids would not be itinerant peddlers. They would set up a dry goods store somewhere. And to this day, we're seeing the effects of that in America, where... you know, the Italian immigrants, for example, didn't necessarily have that infrastructure. But by the second generation, all that Jewish diaspora became shopkeepers.
Right. And watch, well, tinkers a lot of the time, and then department store owners.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's Feldenmeyer's in downtown Kansas City or Milwaukee. They didn't have, you know, they didn't have any kind of the built-in prejudices that a lot of the shop owners would have. So, you know, they'd be in Cuba or the Caribbean selling stuff door to door to poor farmers, to poor plantation workers, you know, they the nicest stuff they'd ever seen.
They're the last ones that would make you feel bad when you walked into the shop.
Right.
And scorn you. Yeah.
Yeah. If those people couldn't, you know, in the South, for example, in the slavery and then Jim Crow post-Reconstruction South, you know, an African-American woman couldn't go into the store in town and get a nice hat or get her dress fit. But the Jewish guy with his cart that came through would call her ma'am and treat her respectfully. So it was kind of for everybody. There was a big market out there that these emigres discovered.
Do you remember Kloppenstein's? Or I guess it was called Kloppenstein's in Seattle, and we said Kloppenstein's in Anchorage. They were like the Nordstrom's. They sold shoes and then became kind of a department store for a while.
Was it a Northwest family?
Yeah, and my dad knew them. And it was, yeah, exactly this, you know, immigrants who then, you know, who built up a store.
The next generation had a general store.
Yeah, and then pretty soon there were four stores, and then there were 14. I don't know if any of them still exist.
By the end of the 19th century, this started to turn into a more corporatized approach to sales. It was no longer just your friendly neighborhood guy wandering the farms of the prairie. He's not a Laura Ingalls Wilde character anymore. In 1886, a bookseller named David McConnell realizes that the women he's meeting with, because often that's who's home during the day, the women he's trying to sell his books to, or his Bible or whatever, they're more interested in the free perfume samples he's giving out. And he later becomes the founder of Avon, you know, the giant cosmetics and skincare empire.
Avon lady.
Ding dong. In 1902, Alcoa, the aluminum outfit, realizes that they can sell aluminum home goods under whatever their ready wear or wear away or whatever their...
Probably not wear away.
I don't think I want to use wear away plates and spoons. What was it called? But anyway, so Alcoa becomes a big door-to-door metal goods.
They also have a Northwest history, Alcoa.
Is that right?
Yeah, they're making that aluminum.
In 1906, a brush salesman named Albert Fuller, gets tired of vouching for his low-quality cleaning supplies to all these housewives. He realizes these people actually want nice stuff, and I'm selling crap. And he decides he's going to start a brush company. And his name being Albert Fuller, this becomes the Fuller Brush Company. As early as the 1920s, the Encyclopedia Britannica employs 2,000 salesmen.
Until the when?
This is early. I mean, this continued until the 80s. And don't you think this is weird that when we were kids, you could go into however nice a bookstore, a university bookstore even, and you could not buy an encyclopedia?
Yeah.
That was not the model.
Right.
The idea was
from a person.
The idea was a person had to sell you on an encyclopedia. And I had never thought about this, but it lent them a real mystique and prestige because you could see these vast authoritative books in the library, but no bookstore seemed to sell them. And I think that was what the industry was based on, was just the idea that
there was some scarcity.
Yeah. A household was buying something that made them special.
Well, and they sold them kind of as a subscription, right?
You'd get one volume.
And that world book or the yearbook that came.
But you'd never get to Zambia or the Zulus if you didn't stick with it.
But you and I both have talked a lot about how important the encyclopedia was to us when we were kids.
But
I remember it being like a real asset.
Yes. But it had not occurred to me until I read this how weird it is that you couldn't see it in a bookstore.
Yeah.
Bookstores had every book but.
Yeah, weird.
And I think that was a lot of the prestige for me was just thinking of this as a special book that maybe, grandma and grandpa had bought a set many years ago and the library had it, but Boy, we don't have an encyclopedia. Where would you even get one?
Well, you know, the Britannica was the one that had the gold on the leaf ends.
And so, I think that was the kind of thing the sales force would push, you know, like right. what a fancy, class mobility pushing
right.
thing you're letting into your home.
Welcome people into your house and go, have you noticed the, but you know, I poured through that Britannica my whole life and they still are like, they look like they're brand new, like they're bulletproof books. So sturdy. And
Do you still own a set?
Oh yeah, I have the one. Well, so my folks bought Britannica from a salesman in 1968 when I was born as an asset for me. They said, we're going to get the Britannica for our son, 1968.
Because, you know, in 15 years, you're going to want to write a report on space.
That's exactly right. And who will ever know more about space than we do now
than in the 1968 Britannica.
And so, but as a kid, you know, there wasn't another source of information. So every time I looked something up, I assumed it was as current as you could possibly be. And I think I continued to think that until, because we also had the World Book.
Yeah, that seemed like it was maybe a little more for kids. Yeah, that was like an educational encyclopedia.
A little bit more down market.
Academics wouldn't use it, but I actually preferred it. It had more color pictures.
Yeah, it had pictures. And also, didn't it have those transparencies of the nervous system?
It's like the H, maybe H for the human body.
Yeah, that was cool. But I swear to you, those books, I mean, I think for a long time I wondered, maybe I still wonder, how could those door-to-door salespeople carry those big, thick books? And it was maybe only later that I realized that they weren't actually—
They didn't have a full case.
Yeah, schlepping them.
But the guy with the sample case, that's what powered the whole endeavor, whether it was vacuum cleaners or brushes or encyclopedias or Bibles. Oh, J.G. Ballard, the novelist J.G. Ballard, was a Britannica salesperson.
Oh.
So was Woody Harrelson's father, Charles.
Before he killed Kennedy.
That is correct. It was before he became a contract killer. He was an Encyclopedia Britannica salesman.
Interesting.
So maybe the experience of trying to sell Britannica to housewives really, really made him violent.
Well, is it causal or is it correlation?
He had to get out of that business because he was so tempted to murder all of the people who did not want to buy a Micropedia and a Macropedia.
If you think about all the murders that didn't happen because those people became door-to-door salesmen instead.
J.G. Ballard might have killed a bunch of people. Mike Myers' dad sold Britannicas.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by our childhood, I think that had mostly switched to, you know, it still wasn't something you could buy in a store, but it was like there were TV infomercials encouraging you to send away for information on the brochure that would let you become a Britannica household.
Weren't they like an insert card in like science magazines, like a certain kind of magazine, you would actually find one of those cards, like buy the encyclopedia.
So something changed between the early 20th century and, you know, the Gen X childhood.
Was it all the murders that door-to-door salesmen committed?
Yeah, probably. Like all the really gullible housewives were dead.
Exactly.
They had been murdered and were no longer interested in buying brushes. No, I mean, obviously a series of societal changes happened that we'll discuss. But, you know, one of the biggest things happened in 1931 in a fairly reasonable-sized city for Southwest Wyoming called Green River.
So there were 800 people in Green River.
Today it has a population of about 12,000, and I think there were over 3,000 people there in 1931.
Oh, because they were mining something?
Yes. Well, at first it was the railroad, actually. Today it's a mining town. Green River is next to the world's biggest deposit of Trona ore. Trona being a kind of an iffy acronym for trisodium hydrogen dicarbonate dihydrate.
Huh.
So it's a salt, and it's basically...
Oh, it's on I-80. I've been through there 1,000 times. I don't think we ever pulled over. There's a taco time there.
Oh, well then let's go. Trona is basically natron, the same salt that the ancient Egyptians discovered would keep their dead pharaohs from rotting away.
Okay.
Trona is now our source of soda ash. What is that? Sodium carbonate, I guess?
You've been on I-80 through there.
I have.
Do you remember where Little America is?
Is that the? It's not where the dinosaurs are.
No, Little America is the one. There's billboards for it.
House on the Rock kind of places.
Yeah,
right?
Pull over, Little America. It's where you can get a.
I've never stopped.
I think maybe one time we did, and it looked like the Corn Palace. Like, nah. But it turns out that Green River is just not very far from Little America. Just trying to locate it for all of the I-80.
For people who know Southwest Wyoming a little, but not.
I would call that.
Precisely.
Yeah Southwest. Yeah, sure.
So today, it's still kind of a booming place where soda ash is mined because you still need soda ash to make glass, to make detergent.
Yeah, it's fertilizer.
It's a water softener. Yeah, food additive. It's used to get sulfur out of coal. A lot of industrial purposes. But when Green River was founded in 1867, I don't know if anybody knew about the borax adjacent stuff that was out there. It was founded as a water stop for the Union Pacific Railroad.
Right. That I-80 corridor is where that railroad went through the past.
And in fact, it's where Green River in particular is where the Union Pacific split. There's one, what do you call that, a branch that goes up through Ohio, or Idaho, up through Pocatello. And another branch that went down through Salt Lake City.
You know, you can see that. You can see the railroad from the highway through most of that. And it's so evocative even still. I look down at it driving through there and just go, the West. Here's how the West was won.
But I'm going faster than a train in my car. Something's wrong.
Yeah, go ahead, train.
And at the time that the town was founded in 1867, the history of it I read says that the Union Pacific had picked this as their watering stop because the Green River that goes through there, the Green River is the river that actually goes, it's the main branch of the Colorado that then goes through eastern Utah. Not our Green River here that generates killers.
That becomes the Duwamish. That's its primary skill. So wait, it goes, how does it go through? Oh, it cuts over. I see. It goes through Utah.
It kind of
there
runs
below the
south
key.
Through,
yeah.
Yeah. And so this was going to be their watering stop, but they get there and they're surprised to find there's already like an adobe settlement there. I think people had already discovered that this was the river. I don't think nobody was squatting hoping to sell it back to the railroad, but the fact that there's already a huge town there makes the railroad think, nope, we're going to actually water the locomotives over here. But then their secondary spot fails, becomes a ghost town, and they end up moving back to Green River.
So what were they doing? Were they out there mining fake emeralds? What were they doing?
Well, a lot of them were railroad workers by the time. I don't know what the original people were doing there. Something on the riverbank,
I guess. There's not a ton to do there.
That's been my experience of most of Wyoming, honestly.
Well, I mean, up in the mountains, there's plenty to do.
Oh, Jackson's nice.
Yeah, you can hunt bighorned sheep.
Yeah, that's why I go, to hunt bighorn sheep. You see my house with the rows of impressive curved horns on the wall. In the years since the Fuller Brush Company and Britannica and all these big outfits had started doing their door-to-door sales, it had really become a dominant means of selling goods in America, as big as catalog sales or even stores. Because you got to remember, for most of the 20th century, people might have lived near a corner grocery that even people, non-rural people, they didn't have access to big box stores much, or department stores.
No.
Convenience stores. Even the corner grocery had bread and milk, but
gumballs, maybe a malted.
maybe a malted if you live in, very close to the.
But if you wanted fine center. China, well, we still talked about that in the 80s. Like if you lived in Missoula, you went to Spokane for school clothes, and that would have been true. Maybe is still true.
But
although
here,
no, you just get it on Amazon.
But here, even in the age of the automobile, you didn't have a mall nearby. You didn't have a Target nearby. Your household goods had to come from somewhere, and a lot of it was just sold by a nice guy showing up during the middle of the day, and women were working in the home, and were happy to have a distraction for him to demo his new goods.
Yeah, like me canvassing, they were happy to invite me in, and then
you were the distraction.
Figure out that I was just.
Oh no, you spilled some coffee on your pants. You might want to take those off. And sales, door-to-door sales had changed by, you know, in 1910, the first kind of national direct sales association had started. The train and the automobile meant that salespeople could no longer, you're not just a guy in a cart anymore. You could cover a big territory.
Right. You see those people in the Delta Lounge all the time.
Yeah, it's still, less and less, honestly. I think Zoom has kind of done a number on these road warriors.
But the guys in the brown shoes that were always going from one place to another.
Talking loudly into their ear.
Yeah, right. But they always seemed, when I would talk to them, they were always selling like giant pumps or like bulldozers. It was always big stuff. They weren't selling little stuff anymore, but they did go door.
I mean, they were selling to businesses.
Yeah, company to company, I guess.
These were the traveling salesmen of all these jokes of the 20th century, romancing the farmer's daughter and arguing about who had the good leads. And
right.
And he's a fake, and he doesn't know the territory.
Sure.
But
coffee for him.
But now they're on Delta getting platinum medallion status instead of riding trains.
Black diamond.
That's not a thing.
No, didn't I ever tell you that story? I was standing outside of a Delta lounge, and I had, you know, my daughter. And I was like, well, can I bring her in? And the lady at the counter was like, no, sorry, it costs $40 to bring a guest. And I was like, at the time she was six. And I said, you're going to let me come in, but not bring my six-year-old? And the person behind the counter was like, sorry, them's the rules. And this guy was standing there with a briefcase, and he'd been tying his shoes the whole time. And he leaned over the desk and he said, I'm double black diamond platinum. Is it okay for me to get the little girl in? And I think all the people behind the desk all stood up and they were like, double black diamond platinum, you know, like molybdenum or whatever. Oh no. And they all got really like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And they were like, yes, absolutely. And he kind of looked at me and gave me a little bit of a wink. And I was like, that was the coolest move I ever saw. And my kid always still talks about it. She's like, remember that guy?
He's the cool kind of road warrior.
Remember the guy that got me into the Delta Lounge? I'm like, do I ever? He's out there somewhere.
This is less related to traveling salespeople, I have to admit. But last week I was coming home from Nashville and they hold us on the tarmac for 20 minutes. And finally, a gate agent comes on board to explain that two pilots are deadheading. And they're oversold, and they're going to have to bump people out of first to let these pilots sit.
Oh, right, because they've got to be somewhere to fly their flights.
Yeah, and so typically, I think a lot of their contracts guarantee them a first-class seat when they have to do this, when they have to shift pilots around.
They're going to bump people out of first.
They're going to bump people out of first.
Oh, how many Karens were on that plane?
Well, they offer, you know, who wants to...
Oh, sure, for $2,500 bucks.
Well, they start at $750. And somebody was like, yeah, I'll go if there's an aisle seat. And they checked and it turns out, no, it's 31B and 31E. It's like the worst middle seats on the plane.
Yeah.
And so nobody does it. And I'm like, ooh, I'm waiting for the money to go up. Because that's always an exciting game at the gate.
Are you in 1A? Oh, no, you're not on the plane yet.
No, I am there. And, you know, yeah, whoever flew me out, I'm in 1F or something, you know. And so I'm waiting to see how high they get. And instead the gate agent just comes back and looks at me and says, yeah, I'm sorry, we're bumping you back to 31B. You're our lowest ranked flyer.
No.
And I'm like, how can I be your lowest ranked flyer? Like, because I have the highest rank on Alaska Airlines. I'm like, I'm a whatever, whatever. I'm MVP, whatever.
Yeah, double black diamond.
And double black diamond. And he's like, And I'm so excited not to go back to 31E because it's kind of a long flight.
Yeah.
Like I still fly in coach and premium economy all the time, but this is kind of a long.
You're just a man of the people.
I sure am. But these guys had bought me a first class ticket, and it's a kind of a long flight.
So did you pull off your fake mustache?
I pulled down my COVID mask, and I was like, hey, you want to ask the pilots if they're Jeopardy fans? You know, and the guy kind of looks at me confused, and I'm like, because I'm the host of Jeopardy, and I'd love to chat with them. You know, I'm really trying to do whatever it takes
here
to
not lose
my...
I've never seen you do this, and this is amazing.
I have never done it.
No, I've never seen it in all the years.
But this is like a five-hour flight, John.
Sure.
And the guy's kind of like, oh boy, like this guy's 100K and he's giving me some spiel about.
Yeah, right.
And I got the flight.
But everybody else in first is 250K?
Well, that's the thing. I think maybe I had,
joined recently.
He explained that it wasn't that. It was that I had a C-class ticket. And I'm like, look, nobody else here is full fare first. I guarantee you nobody. But it could be that they were all groups of two or something.
I see.
And I was the guy flying alone. And so I was going to take it on the chin. And everybody in first class is now super interested. It's like, hey, look, it's that guy.
Yeah, right.
Are they going to bump him down to 31B?
this is a great social media. Is anybody filming it? Because it seems like
I was kind of wondering. And I'm talking to the it was the same flight attendant I'd had on my flight out from Nashville to Nashville the day before. And I was like, hey, are they going to, you think they're going to throw me back? And he's like, boy, I don't know. And I was like, I probably have like more Twitter followers than anybody else.
Oh my God, you were pulling out the clout score.
Well, like, I was just chatting with him. He has no power. Right. He has no power. And he's like, well, don't start live tweeting yet. Like, let's see what happens. And I think the pilot was like, yeah, he's on. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll go. So a very grumpy pilot goes back. And I didn't know they were going to send the pilot back to 31B. I assumed it would just be somebody else who had just gotten upgraded would get the hook.
Well, I would think it would be somebody in 31C that got moved over to 31B.
Exactly. Or somebody from premium economy gets moved back. And then, yeah. But no, they were not going to do any kind of domino effect.
Can you imagine being way back in steerage and a pilot in his full uniform comes and sits in between
in the middle seat?
Oh, wow.
I felt bad about the whole thing, but not as bad as I would if I had been bumped back to 31B.
Absolutely. Listen, Ken, 100%. And so then did everybody else in first class applaud you?
No, they felt like they dodged a bullet. Like, you know, angel of death, nobody's making eye contact because they want the angel of 31B to pass over their house.
I'm really surprised they didn't just keep bumping the money up like that kook on the plane who's like, I'll give you $100,000 to take your mask.
Yeah, I hope that guy sits next to me someday.
I just hope I had the guts to wait till he build it up to, like, if he had said $1,500, I probably would have, okay, fine.
And then he'll tell you, I would have gone to $100,000, you rube. John, did you know buckwheat is not a grain?
How is buckwheat not, if wheat is a grain, how is buckwheat not a grain?
It's just not. It's like a pseudo grain, which means you can use it for a lot of culinary stuff that you use grains for. But that's why like gluten-free people can eat buckwheat pancakes or buckwheat soba.
Huh. Well, what is it? A legume?
It's like
a vegetable?
It's like a grass. It's a grass or a seed, but it's not a grain.
Oh, interesting.
For whatever reason.
Okay, buckwheat's not a grain. All right.
But let me suggest to you another thing you can do with buckwheat besides putting it in your soba or your blini.
Is this an elaborate insult setup? You don't want to know something you can do with buckwheat?
Yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you what you can do.
I'll tell you what you can do with buckwheat. You can put it in an amazing, comfortable, life-changing pillow.
Are we talking about Hullo pillows?
Like the ones offered by our sponsors at Hullo, H-U-L-L-O, pillow.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. I really like my Hullo pillow. Although I would not recommend them for pillow fights because they can pack a wallop. Or maybe I do recommend them.
Yeah, that's how you're going to win every pillow fight.
I only get in pillow fights with a 12-year-old girl, so I'm always pulling my punches. But if you and I got into a pillow fight, I can't imagine the scenario.
Because Hullo is filled with only all-natural buckwheat, it's a great alternative to whatever the petroleum-based foam or bird feathers, that you've been sleeping on every night like a weirdo.
Well, I don't. You know, I avoid feathered pillows like the plague.
You do. But
because
imagine,
they are a plague.
But imagine all the people listening who are just sleeping on feathers every night. Like, that's a normal thing.
What's funny is you check into nice hotels and they often try to broadcast their niceness by having down pillows. Like, oh, we're not like some cheap hotel that has non-full of dead bird feathers pillows.
They're called down pillows because they immediately collapse down to nothing when you put your head on them. And that's not what the human neck needs. Your neck and back will thank you if you try out a firmer pillow like the ones offered by Hullo.
And they're called Hullo, H-U-L-L-O, as a like a reference to the hulls of the buckwheat.
I think so. It's a little pun, right?
Yeah, I like that. Hullo.
They are made in the USA with quality construction and materials. The case is certified organic cotton. Mm-hmm. It's sown for durability. The buckwheat is grilled and milled.
Grilled and milled.
The buckwheat is grown and milled right here in the US of A by our own hardworking buckwheat farmers.
USA America buckwheat?
Shout out. Or if you're from Canada, I hope you don't mind our hardworking buckwheat farmers.
Well, I imagine that there's probably some tariff issue and Canadians are like, we're only using Canadian buckwheat in our pillows.
In either case, this pillow is a life changer. It's not all squishy like the pillow you might be using. It'll keep a shape that's most comfortable for you. Your neck won't be just falling down to the mattress like this every night.
Yeah, you can actually adjust the the density.
How? How do you adjust the density of a buckwheat pillow?
Because it's not a grain, apparently.
It's a pseudo grain.
But it's a collection of hulls you can actually sort of empty out. If it's too firm, you empty some out. If it's not firm enough, you put more in.
It's got a zipper.
It's got a zipper.
So if you empty some out, what you should do is keep that in a separate buckwheat receptacle that later you can put back in if perchance.
If you buy two buckwheat pillows, you can take some of the buckwheat out of one pillow, add it to the other.
As a prank, you can slightly deflate your partner's pillow every night and fill your own buckwheat reservoir.
Only if you're replacing their shoes with one half size smaller shoes every week for a year.
Hello Pillow currently has an amazing deal they're offering to canny omnibus listeners like yourself. They will send you a Hello Pillow or more. You sleep on it for 60 nights, and if you decide at the end of those 2 months that the Hello has not changed your life in your sleep, they'll give you a full refund.
They're not going to resell that pillow. That pillow is...
They promise.
It's dead to the world. They will, if you get more than one pillow, as per my suggestion, they'll give you a $20 discount per pillow.
It's a great gift. Think about who in your life needs a firmer pillow because they're always getting up and saying, you know what? My neck is stiff because my pillow doesn't have enough buckwheat. That's your number one hint that you should be sending them a Hello Pillow.
Mindy stole your Hello Pillow.
I have never got to use my Hello Pillow because Mindy loves a firm pillow.
Well, go to Hello Pillow, and that's HulloPillow.com/omnibus, and try out your Hello Pillow today.
You'll get fast free shipping on every order, knowing that 1% of all profits are donated to the Nature Conservancy. So unless you hate the earth, you should really be taking advantage of this deal.
Give the gift of better sleep. Hello is a unique gift for your family and friends, and they'll appreciate it every night.
Go to HulloPillow, HulloPillow.com/omnibus for this unmissable pillow deal. So traveling sales by the early 20th century has, you know, there's now 93,000 people working in direct sales. It's become corporatized to the degree that the sales manager has been invented, somebody to oversee a fleet of salesmen working a particular region or territory.
See this watch? It costs more than your house.
But unfortunately, you know, this kind of corporate orderly door-to-door world where somebody's demonstrating vacuums for housewives descends into chaos in the late 20s and early 30s with the dawn of the Great Depression. Because what happens is now... you have basically a bunch of drifters. You know, people have been displaced. People are trying to stay alive by selling their household goods. And so what was a nice orderly workforce during the boom time now gets replaced by a bunch of sad Okies in wagons just begging you to take their silverware and their quilt their grandma quilted. And the roads are just choked with these drifters trying to sell you stuff.
And nobody's got the money to buy anything.
Nobody wants to buy it. Everybody's getting annoyed multiple times a day. And the people of Green River, Wyoming have had enough.
Whoa.
Well, the town.
All the way out there.
The town is, I'm not saying this is the epicenter of it, but these guys are largely railroad workers who do night shifts.
Oh, and a bunch of hobos are coming through.
And it's a bunch of hobos every day asking if you want to buy, leather goods or whatever. Please buy my wife's dress. And they're annoyed. Their wives are annoyed. They start petitioning the town council. You have to do something about this terrible nuisance of people coming through on wagons and trying to sell us stuff. My home is my castle. And this is a very American idea, right? That I should be able to kick off the trespassers. There's less of this kind of communal sense, you know, in Europe where the pastures predated the automobile and right. Even the trains, there's some sense that these are public right-of-ways and there's footpaths across my fields and that's all there is to it. But in America, a man's home is his castle.
Sure, keep off my land. There's a white picket fence around it for a reason.
And just this idea, I was reading this recently that privacy is basically a modern invention. You know, like we decide societally what prestige is. And if you're a 17th century king, prestige is having 20 people in your bedroom every morning dressing and bathing you while another 20 people get to watch and 20 other people petition you for favors. The opposite of privacy.
Sounds pretty great, actually.
Is that what you want?
I've always wanted somebody to wake me up in the morning and say, it's time to get up. And if I go, they're like, Mr. Roderick, it's time to get up.
Your audience awaits you. Your ladies in waiting are here.
You know, a newspaper and a cup of coffee and a donut on a tray.
But, you know, our modern idea of success is this is the thing that keeps me away from other people.
Yeah,
You know, it's the whole airport lounge thing. Like, it's the John Hodgman thing. You know, the food's not that much nicer there.
No, it's not.
But what it is a sense that you can go a place where others cannot, and that gives you status.
Until you've been to the Delta Lounge in Atlanta, where it feels like it's more crowded than the airport.
Everyone in Atlanta has gold medallion or higher. You know, it's the same as our Alaska hub here. So they want to be able to say, these hobos are trespassing, and what can we do about this?
Hit them with a fire hose.
And after months of complaints, probably a year or two of complaints to the town council, the town council of Green River, Wyoming, led by Mayor William Evers, drafts ordinance number 175. That sounds a little ominous. They're not going to kill the Jedi or anything.
There were already 174 ordinances in Green River, Wyoming.
I wish I had the complete list.
I know, me
too. The kind of drunken conduct that led to all these very specific laws being passed.
What was the first ordinance?
But here's Ordinance 175, Section 1. The practice of being in and upon private residences in the town of Green River, Wyoming, by solicitors, peddlers, hawkers, itinerant merchants, and transient vendors of merchandise, not having been requested or invited to do so by the owner or owners, occupant or occupants of said private residences, for the purpose of soliciting orders for the sale of good wares and merchandise, and or for the purpose of disposing and or peddling or hawking the same, is hereby declared to be a nuisance and therefore punishable as such nuisance as a misdemeanor.
Wow.
So they make
it clearly they had at least one lawyer in Green River, Wyoming.
Yeah, there's probably
half a dozen lawyers.
No, I know who the lawyer is. In fact, it's one T.S. Tolliver. And in fact, Section 2 says that the town marshal and police force are required and directed to suppress the same and debate this nuisance. So it's now a police matter. And any persons convicted of perpetrating this kind of nuisance, as described above, shall be fined a sum not less than $25 or more than $100. Now, that's pretty high in 1931. That's a lot of money.
Especially if you're a peddler, you don't have $100 to blow.
No, that's that gets fines well into what would be thousands of our modern day dollars.
When I was going door to door, you saw every once in a while a house that had a no solicitors sign stapled to the stairs.
Yes.
And I always left them well alone. They also seem to always have metal gates on their front door. Did you ever see those? And if so, did you respect them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we would knock doors if we could get to the door of a house or an apartment.
A little bit of a nomenclature there. Knock doors.
That's what we say in the trade.
Kind of like knock boots.
Yeah, and then we would knock boots. No, that's what you were doing on your
should have been
on your Beltway adventures. But in this case, I mean, we have a no solicitor sign just because
you do.
Yeah, in Seattle, really, all you get are scammers. Oh, basically, yeah.
Buy these candy bars and help my school football team.
It's generally buy these magazine subscriptions because I'm a underprivileged kid from the wrong side of the tracks.
And then you never get the magazine.
Well, that's the thing. And my wife was like, at one point, no, you seem very nice, you know, because it's always these, you know, well-spoken young men generally have some kind of minority background that really sells them as a striver from their part of town and from the not nice part of town, I think is what's being conveyed. And it turns out, I think they're brought in by these kind of shady organizations.
I've seen that. There's a wrangler down at the end of the block who's kind of running the show.
And my wife said, we did this once before. You know, that sounds like a great cause. We did this once before. None of the magazines came. And the guy just seemed aggrieved, like that we were not in on the hustle.
Yeah.
He was like, yeah, of course the magazines don't come. Can you just write me a check? Like, do you not understand how this con works? And I think to avoid that awkward social scenario, Mindy put up a no solicitor sign. Generally, you know, we have a lot of stairs up to our front door.
You sure do.
Because we're on the side of that hill.
Because you're witches and you live in a
we live in redoubt. A tower. We live in a tower. Like somebody has to drop their hair out the balcony for me to get in.
And so how far up, I've never seen the no solicitor sign. My eyes must just blank it out. How far up the stairs is it?
You have to get all the way to the top.
Oh, wow.
we would like word to get around. You know, if you read this ordinance, you realize that this fundamentally changes door-to-door sales because it means you cannot sell anything to, you can't approach a front porch unless you have been requested or invited to do so by the owner.
Right. You can't even go through the gate.
Yeah. So it's not like you can come in and knock and be like, hey, is it okay if I try to show you my wares? It's illegal to even do that. And as you can imagine, this Green River ordinance puts the fear of God into a whole industry. Because by now, there's things that are being sold coast to coast, Fuller Brushes and Avon Cosmetics and aluminum housewares and all the rest. And knives.
Mary Kay.
Yeah, exactly. Amway has not been invented yet, by the way. But
either has Mary Kay. But, right.
But all these companies are going to spend big money on lawyers and lobbyists to make sure that Green River is told they cannot do this. And in fact, a district judge does issue an injunction saying this seems to be infringing on the ability of this business to conduct its business, and therefore
violates what?
Yeah, exactly.
Federal statute.
Exactly.
Free speech, right to assemble.
I mean, now there's such a broad consideration of commercial speech as First Amendment protected.
Right.
That I don't know if you would get.
Businesses are people, Ken.
Yeah, I think you might get the pro-business result today. But luckily, this is 1931, and a bunch of
socialists
and a bunch of New Deal socialists are still packing the Supreme Court. And that's actually what it comes to. The case of Town of Green River v. Fuller Brush Company goes in front of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
So Fuller Brush does this directly and doesn't try to put together a class action of some kind with all of their other door-to-doors. They're like, no, we're the big dogs here.
Well, I think they have standing.
Yeah.
You know, I think they can say, you know, we've been sending our brush salesmen to Green River, Wyoming.
Look at all the brushes.
We're out this much. The judges on the 10th Circuit Court say that, you know, the district judge regarded the case as close, but found that this is kind of an arbitrary, unreasonable way to regulate the sales that are a part of the fabric of American life. But the 10th Circuit Court finds, no, there's actually a lot of case law showing that, businesses do have the right to do things that are kind of annoying. And that municipalities have the right, that municipalities do have the right to regulate businesses doing things that are annoying. You know, there's a case where a Florida town makes the selling of unripe citrus illegal or something. I think it's maybe a protectionist attempt to keep imported citrus from coming in.
But you see a lot of towns with no billboard ordinances or no fast foods in the town ordinances.
The precedents are kind of interesting because they're really considering whether interstate commerce applies here. You know, like what degree can we overrule Green River, Wyoming?
Oh, it's a states' rights issue.
I guess, yeah. The 10th Circuit finds in favor of the town of Green River and says you can ban door-to-door sales.
Huh.
And as a result, and the Fuller Brush Company takes it to the Supreme Court, which declines to hear the case, which means this is now the law of the land. And Green River ordinances, named for the town of Green River, start to pop up all over America.
But they do.
In every other town where some critical mass of housewives have been annoyed by doorbell ringing.
Did this last until the Reagan administration? This just feels like exactly the kind of thing.
I mean, it's kind of it lasts until in 1951, the Supreme Court does eventually hear Breard v. Alexandria, which is essentially the same kind of challenge. And they agree that, nope, it's fine for the town of Alexandria to do just this. And I think there's a legal consensus today that if this were to go to the Supreme Court, you know, even in the 90s, much less what passes for the Supreme Court today, you would probably get a pro-business ruling on First Amendment grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you can stop those people, you know, you don't want to say that political canvassers can't come to the door. That's kind of broadly protected First Amendment speech.
Right.
So what? Like, that kind of doorbell ringing is a nuisance, but if they're trying to sell you aluminum siding, it's it seems a little thin. So I think that's kind of the idea.
This feels like one of those LSAT questions where the obvious answer is not the answer. I told you that, right? That my girlfriend gave me an LSAT study book one time, and she and I used to sit and...
Yeah, but it seemed like you could just intuit it by the phrasing of the multiple choice questions.
Well, you wanted to think so, but then it ended up...
That's how they get you?
Yeah, a lot of the time you're like, oh, well, this is cut and dry, and then that's why passing the bar exam is hard.
I'm reading T.S. Tolliver, the lawyer who drafted this for Green River and had to defend it in court, saying that Green River ordinances spread out all over the country, but other places have, when they've tried to make them more specific, like it can't be out-of-towners, it can just be local merchants, those often were struck down by the courts.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to mess around. You basically mm-hmm. want to say, it's my porch.
That's the end of it.
Trespass laws give me the right to say who is doing their business on my land.
Hmm.
And, the other thing that happens in 1931, interestingly, so this is kind of the beginning of the end, I think, for this kind of home sales. You know, you're still going to have these guys crossing the country trying to sell to corporate partners, to stores, to, you know, sell your pump to a factory or a plant or whatever. But this is a big blow to these door-to-door sales companies.
And as early as the Depression.
1931, yeah. Other things happen later. The same year that the Green River Ordinance passes in Wyoming, Stanley Home Products thinks of a new way that it can sell its kitchenwares, which is, what if we tell housewives that they can throw a party?
Mm-hmm.
And show all their friends. Basically, they invent the Tupperware gimmick. Mm-hmm. They can show their friends this stuff. And
then they'll make a little bit of Ponzi scheme.
I'm not sure if it uses the MLM model yet. It may be that the salesman comes to your house.
Well, she gets free Tupperware.
Yeah, exactly.
Tupperware.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
She gets hers free. And so this becomes the model that becomes very sustainable in the 50s of housewives throwing parties and leads directly into the multi-level model of Amway. In, I have that year here. I think it's also in the 50s. I mean, what happens, there's a boom actually in the 1950s in this kind of sales and people wanting to throw these parties and wanting to make, and it's because all these women had great jobs during the war and suddenly the men are home from Europe and the Pacific and then Korea. And those jobs have gone away, and all these women are at loose ends, and they want a little extra household money. And Amway and the like start to fill in the vacuum. But that eventually is the same product that dooms the whole endeavor, because the women that are working are not sitting at home waiting for the doorbell to ring. I'm trying to think the last time I remember in about 2003 or 2004, we had just moved into a little first starter home outside Salt Lake City. I hadn't been on Jeopardy yet. And I'm at work one day and Mindy has a vacuum salesperson come by.
Vacuum.
And he's like, these, whatever they were, they weren't Dysons, but something like that. These are amazing Electrolux or whatever. I'm going to show you by vacuuming your whole house. And Mindy says, oh boy. And lets Dracula in, basically.
Right.
And you never want to say, oh boy, to the...
No.
If you just see this brief presentation about timeshares.
Yeah.
And then we'll...
You can spend the whole week in Hawaii.
Yeah, your resort room will be half off. And that's what Mindy finds out, is that the guy just is going, for an hour, he's talking, because he's trying to wear you down.
Yeah.
He wants you to feel bad enough about not buying anything that you buy something.
He got in.
So for an hour, he's... talking her ear off about the many advantages of his full line of vacuums and why you really want the new 6500. And finally, the guy's been here an hour and Mindy's like, you know what? Like, sorry, I have to make dinner. Like my kid's going to be waking up from his nap. You haven't vacuumed anything. Get to work.
That is consistent with what I know about Mindy.
And the guy grumblingly does the vacuuming he promised to do and left without a sale.
But
that was, that 2003.
Yeah, really late for vacuum salesmen.
It was kind of dying then, and it was largely, it was a couple things. It was fewer people at home to market to. It was the fact that you could buy anything that a door-to-door salesman had 5 minutes from your house in any number of big box stores. You didn't have to wait to get a special vacuum because you could get that vacuum at Target. And it's also, you know, consumer protection agencies getting mad about all the scams.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these door-to-door guys, as the industry became less profitable, a lot of these respectable encyclopedia salesmen got replaced. And I'm sure there were always people overcharging you for the embossed Bible that they were going to sell you with your wife's name on it for a birthday present.
Yeah, or the Franklin Mint that wants you to buy a quarter that's been hand-painted.
Were those ever door-to-door?
I don't know. They sure feel like that kind of scam,
don't they? I remember the magazine ads for sure.
Special 1 ounce gold ingot, but a gold painted ingot.
But as more and more of this was crooked, you know, nobody wanted to open the door to somebody because it really was going to be somebody trying to scam grandma. I saw a list in 2012 where Forbes magazine was reporting on 10 dead or dying career paths. And
podcaster would be right at the top now.
Well, interestingly, yeah. I mean, you know what podcaster was in 2012? 61% drop over the last 5 years in stage performers, jugglers, dancers, magicians. For whatever reason,
that's why we're all so depressed.
Live variety performance had really taken a hit. And I guess 2012, you can blame the internet, but not yet phones.
What happened to the jugglers?
Most of them are being lost to technology. It's photo developers. It's photo lab jobs are going away.
Does anybody remember laughter?
Did the jugglers make you laugh a lot?
They did.
When they dropped
hilarious like skits that they did.
Remember what were they called? The Flying Karamazov Brothers? There were celebrity jugglers.
Yeah.
I think we need to do an omnibus on the forgotten celebrity juggler.
Plate spinners.
And U.S. Postal Service mail sorters. I had a friend who did this as a summer job. If the handwriting was bad on a letter, somebody sitting somewhere had to look at each one and type in a zip code into a machine. Now, of course, that either, you know, the software is so good that you don't need those people
anymore. Was it because of a decline in mail?
No, I think it's just that...
computerized.
I think it was just the tech was getting better at predicting where all the stuff was going. It's the beginning of the... I mean, it's nothing like the future shock we're seeing with AI solutions today, but it was the very beginning of, cheap piece of software is awfully good at your job, sir, which you thought was a very human task. And on this list of TED dead or dying career paths, door-to-door sales appears. The funny thing is, in the next decade after Forbes published that list, door-to-door sales actually stabilized and started to skyrocket.
Really?
And I think it's general economic woes and the gig economy pushing people out of what had seemed like safe job perches. And so now there's a vast America trying to sell stuff door to door, but it's via multi-level marketing.
But do you feel that people are more receptive to answering the door to a person with a valise?
Maybe it's because we live in a major city that you don't see this. I mean, I don't know. I assume a lot of this MLM stuff is mostly like affinity marketing. You're trying to sell to people you know. So it's less like, hey, I was just in the neighborhood and I wanted to tell you about these amazing essential oils. And it's more like, hey,
Facebook friends.
Yeah. Hey, Facebook friends. And to some degree, it'll still be door to door. Cause it'll be like, I'd really like to come over and show you. I think what they often say is, I just signed up to do this thing and I'd like to practice on some friends first. Do you mind if I come over and practice my spiel on you?
Oh, wow. That's a trick on a trick.
That's what they tell you to do. And then that becomes the guilt the friend into why aren't I thought you were maybe you're not going to buy the new this look at this toenail polish, look how good it looks on you.
I feel like my whole scam of being a door-to-door dildo salesman actually has a great opportunity there.
Is that what you were doing in DC?
Yeah. You mind if I come by and just show this to you?
I'm going to start off with the Clean Water Act, but boy, you won't believe the second act.
And that concludes the Green River Ordinance, entry 549.RV0320, certificate number 12881 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, go over to my Facebook page and check out my selection of Dido's.
Nutritional supplements?
Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, you'll find other Futurelings hanging out, being fun, being hilarious folks. And if you are a hilarious folk, you can join in. If you are not hilarious folk but likes to spy on hilarious folk.
How do you know? How do you know if you're hilarious enough to lurk or not?
I'm not sure. Maybe if you think you're hilarious, that's an indication that you're not. I've never been 100% sure on that. You can see, speaking of thinks he's hilarious, you can go to @KenJennings on Twitter and see his sparkling content. @JohnRoderick, what am I trying to do on there? Boy, I'm not sure.
It's hard to say.
Stay out of the way is what I'm trying to do, but I can't help myself. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. And you can send us mail to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. Looks like you've got a whole bunch of encyclopedias over there.
I'm opening the mail right now.
What do you got? What is it? You see, like a stack of books.
This is very exciting. Zach works in a place I didn't know existed, the Library of Congress Publishing Office.
Whoa.
The U.S. Library of Congress has its own publishing arm to produce works about the library itself, which seems a little...
Not duplicating books that are in the library, but actually about the library.
Well, it seems like some of them may be anthology-like. For example, he sent us American Feast, which is kind of a collection of interesting cookbooks.
Looks like he's got
in the Library of Congress.
Some post-it notes in there. Is he directing our attention to certain things?
Maybe. Well, the letter includes highlights. I think this is what it is. The first ever pumpkin pie recipe.
Thank you.
Oh, the joy of cooking. That ties in. He wants to draw my attention to pages 30 to 31. About a legendary celebrity bartender of the 19th century. That's actually a pretty good omnibus idea.
A mixologist, we call them.
This book includes sections about the first cookbook ever written by a black man, The House Servants Directory, the first cookbook written by a freed, formerly enslaved woman, What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking, the first Yiddish cookbook in the U.S., not even going to try to pronounce that. This is fantastic. And then two other books from the Library of Congress Crime Classics series.
Wow.
Did you know this existed?
No, I did not.
The Library of Congress is republishing historic mystery novels that have fallen into obscurity and presumably out of copyright with new contextual introductions and notes. Oh, this is good. Rudolph Fischer's The Conjure Man Dies from 1923 is the first full-length mystery novel by a black author.
How cool are these?
This is amazing. The other book is The Master of Mysteries, a series of short stories featuring Astro the Seer, a soothsaying type of a Sherlock Holmes. The interesting thing is it's by Gillette Burgess, best known for writing the short doggerel verse, I never saw a purple cow, I hope I never see one.
Uh-huh.
We're only remembering for that, but apparently we should be remembering for him for his beloved character, Astro the Seer.
Well, Astro the Seer's book there appears to be a 600-pager.
It's big.
Yeah, it is. It's a fat stack.
I mean, some of that is explanatory notes by, no less than Leslie S. Klinger, who I think wrote the annotated Sherlock Holmes I have. This is fantastic stuff, Zach.
Very nice.
I'm going to start buying the complete works of the Library of Congress publishing.
Well, you already have quite a few Library of America volumes.
I'm going to switch. I'm going to burn all my Library of America volumes. And I'm only going to read out-of-print stuff that the Library of Congress is reprinting. Chris from New Jersey wanted to send us this photograph he took of Zippy, the zip code guy.
But he's dressed as a leprechaun.
Yeah, apparently it's a seasonal St. Patrick's Day thing. He sent this to us in early March, so...
Well, but here it is.
They dress up Zippy. This is from the Free Franklin Post Office and Museum in Philadelphia. There's a mini postal museum...
Is Zippy always bright orange?
Was Zippy? It looks. Is that red?
I don't think that is his normal color.
The post office there will stamp your mail with a reproduction of Ben Franklin's old postmaster stamp. He didn't. He he didn't go all the way there to get do that so done. For this. What? Why is it called the Be Free Franklin Post Office? Are we supposed to think Benjamin Franklin's middle name was Free? Did he change his name to World Be Free during his NBA career?
World Be Free. That was his late 80s Beatles sounding pop act.
Oh, I see. He wrote Be Free Franklin. That was the stamp that his his cancellation stamp. I don't know why it would say that.
Be free.
But it did.
It was just his way. It's like his rainbow gathering greeting.
I'm very interested
Yo,
in
be
this.
Be free.
I'm very interested in this this cancellation stamp you can only get at the Independence National Historic Park.
Collect them all.
And finally, there's this pretty sizable thing that says, what does it say? It says, for Ken and John, gifts from Japan.
Okay. I think I was receiving messages about this.
I think this is the guy who was tweeting at me like 2 to 3 times a week to ask why I wasn't picking up his package yet at the post office.
Seems like it might be him.
I guess
he and I have communicated, I think.
Getting a little nervous about. Online. I mean, here's the thing. I don't do errands when someone tweets at me to do them.
Yeah, but this might be full of like bananas
well,
or something.
I think what he was getting was the Postal Service kept saying, okay, we delivered it, but of course if the owner of the P.O. box doesn't pick it up before such and such a date, it'll be returned to you. And I think his anxiety was kicking in every time he would get one of these auto notifications.
Right, probably because it's $60 in postage. Although, maybe not. You know, I see things from Japan that don't cost a lot of money.
Holy cow, this thing is a treasure trove.
Look at all those wonderfully wrapped.
The last hour of the show is going to be me
unpacking this huge box.
Oh my gosh. The funny thing is, it's one of these compact, fixed postage priority mail boxes, but it's just stuffed to the gills.
Look who it is. It's fan of the show, Little Booty McBooterson.
I didn't realize.
Oh, we turned it up because we get cold.
It's in the comfort zone.
Would you like to say hi to the futurelings? No, she didn't say. She didn't say a word.
I was thinking of something to say.
Go ahead and say it.
Bonjour.
There you go. We've only had a couple of guests on the program.
I just heard about your wrist and your foot. I'm so sorry about your trampoline injuries.
Maybe Ken will sign your cast.
Do they even have that anymore?
Yeah.
You can sign the new soft kind.
We'll get the silver pen. All right, skedaddle.
Wow, you really went from hey, get on the show to hey, get out of here.
That's my parenting style. World famous
for John's adventure bag, a 1980s Austria souvenir patch,
kept
by my mom in a drawer. This actually is pretty good.
Let me see. Oh, that's beautiful.
It's sparkly. What else do we have here? Two very old stamp collecting books, if you would care to organize your stamps.
Are they not full of stamps?
They're not, but they're like 80s era Japanese.
That's pretty.
They're so old that they were like only like 200 yen or so when they were bought. This one must be a little more recent.
Can they be used as diaries, or are they just for stamps?
Well, they've got the rows of kind of
oh, I see.
Mylar shelving where you can...
Oh, you could put tiny little... like photos that you take at the bus station.
It doesn't have to be stamps.
Yeah.
Do you go around to the bus station and go into the photo booth and taking little photos of yourself?
Every bus station in America. It's like going to every Starbucks.
Let's see, what is this? Some kind of towel that says
Konnichiwa.
Jutoku.
What is it? Is it a sports team? It looks like a sports towel.
It does look like I now support the Jutoku Mighty Magpies or something.
That's cool. Even if used as a dish towel.
Ooh, the Yomiuri Shimbun, January 1st, 2023 edition. Here's a post that must have fallen off something else that says 2017, 4 stamps for the 2020 Olympics. Wow.
This is a real specialized group of presents.
I wonder if there's like a bill of lading that I missed with a complete list. This zippered package appears to have all kinds of Japanese, annotated Japanese snacks, chocolate bars. I mean, most of them are snacks, but then there's a copy of 1980, or of Homage to Catalonia, not in Japanese.
By George Orwell. Why did that come in this?
Candy beans for your daughter's papercraft mask kit.
Okay.
Some Choco Mint room temperature ice cream sandwich type product.
Right. Got to be delicious.
This looks like a CD, but I can't tell who. Oh, Western State Hurricanes in Japanese.
What?
Have you ever seen, do you have one of these? Do you always get a copy?
I don't believe that it was available in Japan unless.
Probably not licensed.
It's a bootleg.
He's sending you your own bootlegs.
Did he make this or is this real?
I don't know. That's a good question. It's very delicious konpetu. Let's enjoy nostalgic time. So candy with funny Asian English on it.
Mm-hmm. That's how we got our band name.
So nothing in this candy is in English except it says clear edible inner wrapper.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we used to eat those when I was a kid. Do you remember those?
I think we were talking about these on the show, weren't they? Paper candies?
Yeah.
Oh, these are the Japanese Olympic stamps. New Year, baseball newspaper pages. So
that seems like something.
Japanese newspaper supplements. This says for Ken, and I don't know. Let's see, what is it? Oh, it's some kind of Japanese baseball times. Wow, including stats for all the teams, all the newly drafted players. This is fantastic. I'm really going to enjoy this, and I think my son will as well.
This does appear to be, well, I don't know. I can't tell whether that he made this on a color copier or whether this is.
You were right about Jutoku being a sports team. It's a high school. But, oh, maybe he teaches at the school. We won our prefecture championship, but lost in the semifinal nationals. So an elite high school baseball team. Here's a demon mask that your daughter can make out of paper.
Yes.
Really, there's just no end to this stuff. And I'm in awe.
Fantastic.
A box from John Willis in Japan. Well, we know.
John.
We know that's who it is. An antique float he got at a flea market. Oh, it's one of these. Have we talked about these?
The
Japanese glass floats.
Yeah.
Wow, and it made it all the way here thanks to a combination of styrofoam and this washcloth and then this padded cozy.
You know, they used to make it all the way here through the ocean.
Right, but I would trust the ocean over the U.S. Postal Service. He sent me a Valentine's Day choco. No wonder he wanted us to pick it up. And even one for your sister.
Oh, one for Susan. She'll appreciate that. She always feels underappreciated by the futurelings.
Yeah, it's true. They never send her anything. Two rocks from Mount Fuji?
No, really? That seems like a big deal.
I feel like there's nothing left in Japan at this point. Thank you so much, John. This was definitely worth the wait for us. I hope it was for you.
John, you're the
as
king.
As well. Did you...
No. In conclusion, just like John, you should join the Omnibus Project Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We do a monthly addenda show that's basically just like the mailbag, except it doesn't include mostly any rocks from Mount Fuji.
You know how long that segment was? What if that was over an hour? Yeah, that's the addenda show.
What if that was a whole show? It's really fun.
It's good.
And it increases your number of omnibuses by 20%. So that's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows... Ooh, peach-flavored Kit Kat. If Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.